Well, if I want to be wealthy, I got to be invested in real estate. Actually, in college, I bought my first duplex when I was 19. I really want to encourage anybody that's listening to this. It doesn't matter if you're a doctor making six figures or if you're making minimum wage. There are things that you can do that are going to set you for financial success down the road if you're willing to do these steps. In investing, if you put money in a savings account, it's not bad for you, but it's not going to make you wealthy, right? In order to get wealthy, you've got to get much better returns than the rate of inflation. And savings accounts, I'm sorry, almost all the time are just not as good as the rate of inflation. Stretch your mind a little bit, do a little bit of extra legwork, do the work to get it set up, get the management systems in place, you can live for free. And then take the money you would have spent on that mortgage and start putting it towards your future, and you can build a multi-million dollar net worth. I don't care what you make as a salary.
This is your Real Estate Syndication Show. I'm your host, Whitney Sewell. Our guest today is Brian Tibbs. He got into real estate actually when he was 19 years old. He bought his first duplex while in college. He's going to share how he did that. But man, the path that that took him over the next number of years up to today is a path that you can also learn from and take almost at any part of your journey in investing or your career. He's going to lay out a method today that he calls the hacker method, which I appreciated. And what I love is that it's an encouragement to anyone at any amount of income that you can also invest. But he was also an executive at his dad's financial services business. He was co-owner of another online retailer over the many years. There he got married, he resigned, he sold his online business and liquidated a large portion of his real estate portfolio. And he moved to Guatemala, where he was a full-time missionary. He was CEO of a foundation that was doing some incredible things. But guess what? His real estate portfolio supported them, he and his wife, while they were full-time missionaries. And he came home from being a full-time missionary and could pretty much retire. So I just want that to be an eye-opening thing for you, the listener, to know that, hey, no matter where you're at, no matter what your income is, that you can start investing today, and you're gonna learn many of those methods today from Brian. Well, I'm excited about today's interview. Our guest today is going to help empower almost anyone to know that, hey, they can also invest in real estate and other ways to build some wealth, no matter what your, say, hourly wage is or income. And I'm excited about that. I love just the mindset that, hey, anybody can do this and you can feel equipped, to be able to go and make this happen, no matter what your income is. Brian, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Whitney. It's great to be with you and your audience. Thanks for the opportunity.
Honored to have you. And I'm just looking forward to diving into your path a little bit, obviously, to being able to be a passive investor, right? And being able to manage your wealth and that be the thing that you do. Because that's not the typical thing we think of, right? Often, especially from, say, a background that you had. Right. So I want to dive in there. Let's go back a little bit. Early exposure, say, to real estate, or when that happened compared to when you were doing, I want to let you share it, but when you were, early on, how'd you get into this space?
I did not grow up in a family that was a family of investors. My dad was a small business operator, owner operator, but I wouldn't have thought of him as an investor. And then I remember when I was 16 or 17 years old, overhearing him and my grandfather talk about going in together to buy a duplex. And I never even heard the word duplex before. And I didn't know what they were talking about. And when I figured out that they wanted to buy two homes, find perfect strangers, and trust that they were going to pay them rent and go get a loan and then have to pay the loan and unclog toilets and all these things that maybe somebody who hasn't been exposed to investing would have fears about. As a kid, I thought, this is insane. Why would you do this? And I just couldn't get past the fact that they were going to have to pay interest payments for 30 years. I just thought that was insane. And so I was kind of just listening in on a conversation, eavesdropping. And then when I heard them say, okay, let's call the agent and make an offer, I felt like I had to step in and stop them, right? Because I'm this know-it-all 16, 17-year-old. So I just barged in and I said, you guys can't be serious. You really are going to do this. And they realized that I had been listening, and their focus shifted from making this deal to the noble cause of helping a 17-year-old kid learn a life lesson, right? And so we probably spent the next couple of hours just going back and forth and me throwing out every objection I could think of and them telling me how they thought through that. Like, you know, we've accounted for some vacancy. We've accounted for some lost rent. We've accounted for repairs. We're going to hire a manager to unclog the toilets. We're not going to do it ourselves, you know, all the way down the line. And by the time we got through the end of the conversation, I was like, okay, well, show me how this makes any sense. Because you're telling me you're going to make like $50 a month and that doesn't make any sense, right? And they went through and they showed me. And when they went through all the math of holding this duplex for 10 years, I saw that they were going to triple their down payment. It was like, oh, okay. And then I said, well, what if we did 2 or 3 or 5 or 10 of these? And then they're like, okay, now we know he gets it, right? And so it was that moment, you know, that young age of 17 or whatever it was, that I was like, okay, I want to be a real estate investor. And then as I started to look into it, now this is pre-internet time, right? You don't just go Google, what does it mean to be an investor? I just started looking around and noticing that everybody in my life that I knew that was wealthy was involved in real estate in one way or another. Either they started there or they made a lot of money doing something else and put their money there, right? And so I just very primitively said in my mind, well, if I want to be wealthy, I got to be invested in real estate. And so that's how I got started. And right out of, actually in college, I bought my first duplex when I was 19. And then just made the goal that I was just going to add units every year. And that's how I started out.
I love the teaching mentality of, it seems like your father and grandfather, right? And I would even enjoy, or I'm hoping anyway, when my sons come to me in that way, like, Dad, what are you doing? You know, I'm hopeful that I can take that as a great thing, right? Oh, you're okay. Right. You are thinking about this and I want to teach you, right? I want to be able to answer your questions and help you think through this. Sounds like they did that. And wow, you know, the impact, right, that's had on your life and now future, your family, and now, you know, many others, right? Yeah. And so even to the point to where, you know, what, 2 to 3 years later, you're buying your own duplex. You're obviously completely bought into this real estate thing. Because how did you get the duplex at 19? You're in college. What were some of the ways you made that happen?
Yeah. So I wasn't necessarily going to buy a duplex at 19 years old, but I got to the point now where I had to move out of the dorms and I didn't want to pay rent because I'd learned the concept that people who are paying rent are paying off somebody else's mortgage. And so I didn't want to do that. And I didn't want to have to, and I couldn't afford to just pay a whole mortgage myself. And now these were back in the days of, you know, what they call now liar loans, where basically anybody could get a loan. You just had to tell them what your income was and it's, you know, approved. And super low down payment. So I only put $2,500 into my first duplex. It was a brand new build. It was a $120,000 building. And I put tenants in the one side and I got roommates on my side and almost covered the mortgage. So it got it to where I could actually afford the payment. And so that's how I got started. And then my second duplex, I borrowed $10,000 from my grandfather who was giving me that lesson. So I borrowed $10,000 from him and then just worked like mad to pay him off and paid the first mortgage off as well. And, you know, just every deal from there on, I was just being as creative as I could on limited income to build the portfolio.
Why did the bank give you a loan at 19?
Yeah, I don't know. I did have a job. I had a stable job. Maybe they thought I was credible. I don't know. It's so long ago. And I've had other people ask me that question. And I've had people are 18 years old try to get loans and not get approved today. So now I know lending standards then were very relaxed. It was, you know, Bill Clinton was really pushing home ownership. And so there was just a lot of push for people to get into their first home. And, you know, so yeah, I can't answer that for sure. I don't remember, but I just did it.
Definitely a different lending environment, to say the least. Yeah. But I just want to encourage listeners, there's still ways to make it happen.
Absolutely.
Even if you are 19 right now. There are just, you know, don't give up because it's a different quote lending environment, right? That's going to be every, you know, all the time it's changing.
So, well, there's still the 3.5% down FHA loans, which is, you know, very affordable, you know, and I say $2,500, that was in 1996. So what is that? 7,500 now, you know, adjusted for inflation. So it was a different world back then.
So, you know, speak to some of the next steps that happened, you know, for you, your life, your journey into real estate. But I know there's some other turns there.
So I had been adding units every year, and I actually got up to about 10 units. I was probably 23 years old. I had 10 units. It wasn't making money. It was maybe breaking even the real estate in those days. I was just really focused on the long game of building wealth. Was attending a church, and I really started feeling a calling towards serving full time. As a missionary. And I thought that was, even when I first started feeling that way, I thought that that's absurd. Why would God want me to do something like that? And I really resisted it. It took me about a year before I finally accepted the fact that that was what I was supposed to do. I was dating this girl at this time. And when I decided, okay, I'm going to go ahead and be obedient and I'm going to move over, I don't know, move someplace to go study, or maybe I'm going to move to another country. And I don't know, I'm going to lose my real estate. I'm going to lose my business. I'm going to lose my girlfriend. I'm going to, lose everything and go away. So I told my girlfriend that day, I said, I really feel like I'm supposed to be a missionary. And so, I was kind of waiting for her to say, well, this was fun. But she said, well, funny, I've always felt the same thing. And so we went from me thinking we're going to break up. We actually got married a year later. And then a year after that, we moved to Guatemala sight unseen with just what would fit in our four suitcases and started what became a 16-year journey of doing mission work overseas.
Incredible. I love that. I love that when the Lord shows up in ways like that, you're thinking, oh, it's all going to crumble, but man, he just had a plan through your obedience. Right. And I love that. Love that. So you all moved away. How much real estate did you own at that time?
We had 10 units.
Okay. Interesting. So you had 10 units, because most missionaries, it's a major issue, right? It's like, how are we going to survive financially, when we move across the world to go serve in this way? I hate there's that barrier there for almost all of them, right? But I love that through your story, hey, there's another way potentially, right, for them to support themselves. So you had 10 units at this time. Was that something that could support you and your new bride, as you all moved, a long ways away?
Yeah. So it's a kind of a crazy story. We ended up actually, this was in 2000. We moved to Guatemala in 2005. So we had 2005 and then we had 2006 and then we had everything fell apart in the real estate market. Right. And after we had moved to Guatemala, I think it was after we had moved to Guatemala. Well, I had sold I had sold one of the duplexes. So we were down to 8 units. And then I had someone come and offer me just a price that I couldn't refuse on my fourplex. And so we went from 6 to 8 back to 4 units, and then the market fell apart. And I had actually paid off the rest of the real estate. So I had 4 units paid off, and that was what we were living on for the first bit while we were living overseas. And then when the market fell apart, in 2009, I took that cash and I went reinvested it, and we started buying more units. And boy, that was scary. I mean, everybody says now, oh yeah, good move, but it was scary at the time. I mean, there was people on the news saying that capitalism is dead, the real estate market will take decades to come back, if ever. And I mean, it was a scary time, and there was nobody buying. You hear kids today say, well, if I could go back to 2008, I'd just buy all the real estate I could. Yeah, that was not the environment back then. It was a scary time. So anyway, I had no income, literally. We were volunteers. I had no income, but we had some cash stashed away. And so we started investing. And we did actually, after our first 3 years, we started raising support, the traditional model for missionaries where we had donors that would pay our living expenses. And I always looked at the real estate as, I've got to keep this going because I know there is no retirement on the other end. And, as we all know, Social Security is on very shaky ground. And so I'm not going to rely on that. There's no pension backup plan for me. And there's no golden parachute, like most CEOs of organizations. I founded my own nonprofit and was the CEO. There's no golden parachute for nonprofit CEOs, at least not at our level. So we looked at real estate as that's our path to having a dignified retirement. So that's what kept us going on that.
I love the story. I love how you all were able to support yourself, how you were able to manage this. Speak to just a couple things maybe that helped you to be able to manage your units while being so far away as well.
I often point to that as being obviously it was a challenge. It was an obstacle, but it was probably the best muscle builder in terms of business leadership that I had, because I had to rely on other people to do a good job. Now, I had to keep my eye on it because it doesn't just happen on automatic. We talk about passive investing, and And I think if somebody wants to live true to the word of passive, where you don't do anything but maybe cash your check or verify that the EFT landed in your account, you're probably not going to get as good of returns as someone who's paying attention to the operator, paying attention to the returns, paying attention to how things are performing, shuffle when things are changing. You know, I think even passive investors need to actively be paying attention to what's going on, you know, managing the manager, so to speak. And so I was involved, but obviously I couldn't run over and unclog a toilet at 10 o'clock at night. That just, I had to rely on other teams. And so I built out a team. You know, anybody who's done real estate investment can probably understand the frustration with the typical property manager, right? The professional property management firm. I went through probably 7 or 8 of them. And I just never found one that I did find one that I really liked. And then he went out of business because he didn't charge enough and he worked too hard. And so I ended up just building my own team. And that was a challenge, doing it from 5,000 miles away. And I was living in Argentina at the time, which is 1 hour east of East Coast time. So from mountain time to east of East Coast time, you know, it was a 4 hour difference in time. So that was a challenge. But that was the best thing that I could have done, because when we did finally come back to live in the U.S., we had this team built out that was functioning really well, and I had developed the skills of being a true CEO of an organization rather than a, you know, hands-on manager.
Love that, how you look back at that and say, hey, this helped prepare me, you know, for other things. I know you were, some research I'd done on you, you were doing big stuff in other countries as well, right? I mean, you were managing a lot of people and a lot of big projects. And it sounds like maybe you can highlight there a little bit about how that prepared you also.
I think my time in South America was, I mean, obviously it was very formative. We built the organization from just my wife and I to over 100 people on staff, and we planted 96 churches in 11 different countries and found, trained, and sent 380 some missionaries to do that work, and raised over $20 million for the cause as well. And so, a lot of those skills, obviously the fundraising skill has started to come in handy here as I'm raising funds for the projects that we're doing here in the U.S. But just the leadership development, John Maxwell put out a book called The 21 Immutable Laws of Leadership. And one of the concepts that he kind of imprinted there is, he said, if you want to see the true leader, find a leader of volunteers, because they're there because they want to, not because they're getting paid. And that's so true. It is so hard to lead volunteers. And so we kind of cut our teeth doing that. And I think that affects the way that we treat our staff. And I think in a positive way, and just makes our leadership game a little bit better. So,
yeah. Yeah. Love that. Love the heart of the volunteer as well, or somebody that's leading volunteers, right? Like I said, that is interesting. Way to find somebody like that. I'm going to remember that. Speak to the progression of your, say, real estate investing or portfolio, kind of what's happened, you know, since then.
You know, from the very beginning, like I said, I bought a brand new build, brand new construction build. So it was probably the most expensive thing that I could have bought, but I was nervous as a 19-year-old. I didn't know how to do sheetrock repair. I didn't know how to, you know, do plumbing work or electrical. I didn't know how to do anything. And so I just really didn't want to have any problems. And so that was a super safe entry into real estate. I've even got the warranty from the builder. If something goes wrong, I just call him and he comes back and fixes it. So, and really when I was overseas, I didn't have, not that you couldn't, but I just didn't have the bandwidth to do heavy remodels. And so I had agents that I relied on that I trusted. I just always bought things off of the MLS, did very minimal repairs like carpet and paint, basically, is what I would be willing to do, because I was managing it from a distance and I really was focused on the mission. I just really couldn't put a lot of attention onto the real estate. And it was a buy it and hold it and let it go up in value play, really. When the market crashed, that's when we started to invest back in. But again, the first four buildings that I bought were brand new builds from a builder that had been really struggling, and then they gave me a great deal, obviously, to keep them going for that year of 2009. And so just stuff like that to get through that process. Then in 2021, when we decided that our time in the field was done and we're moving back to the United States, moved back to the US, and I by then the real estate was performing so well that we didn't need to go get another job. We were essentially, you know, retired from a W-2. And so I was like, well, I'm just going to focus on kind of my first love, this real estate, and I want to grow this. And I remember thinking, but I don't know much about real estate. We had 17 units. You know, we were financially independent. We were multimillionaires, and I didn't know much about real estate. And so I just Googled real estate education, and Bigger Pockets popped up. And I remember I saw Bigger Pockets, and I thought, isn't it Deeper Pockets? You know, I didn't understand the Bigger Pockets thing. But anyway, I started digging into that, and just to kind of get up to speed on the lingo and the burr and, you know, all these different terms. You know, they said house hack. For me, it was buy one, live it, or rent one side, live in the other. That was what I called it, right? And so, yeah, so just kind of getting up to speed. And since then, we've started buying really ugly houses, forcing equity by rehabbing them and then putting them into our rental system and going there. So we've doubled our portfolio since 2021, a little more than that. And last year, I launched my first partnership fund. I'd done everything just on my own up until last year. And so we launched our first partnership fund last year, and we're just about to buy our last building in that fund now. And then going forward, who knows? We'll see how things develop.
I just love how you all built your portfolio slow but fast.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I love how you all had the ability to stay focused in the mission field.
Yeah.
You know, and the financial burden that's on most missionaries, right? That and the Lord just provided a way there that only He could have, right? But to fund you all in that way, and even bless the nonprofit, you know, that you all had started, and love that raise $20 million. What a success story, you know, around that mission, and then to be able to come home and not to have to almost start a career from scratch, right? I feel like a lot of missionaries have to do that, right? They go to the mission field for many years and come back, and it's like they're starting as a 21-year-old in a you know new career again, right? But are much older, and so I love that. But now, you know, I think even your philosophies have progressed, your ability to, you know, your knowledge base, all these things, to the point you've written a book and focused around this thing you're calling the Hacker Method, right? I want to jump into that. And maybe you could break that down, that method, for us. The listeners and I can understand this method as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So yeah, this is the book here, The Hacker Method, The Unexpected Investor's Guide to Building Wealth Even on Limited Income. So as missionaries, if you took our total salary that my wife and I made from our donors that showed up on our W-2 on our tax returns, and divided that into the number of hours that we worked, we made $9.20 an hour average. Okay. So we were on a very meager income. That's lower than the minimum wage in Arizona right now, by the way. So we made a very meager wage from our W-2 job. And yet we were still able to build a multi-million dollar net worth that was creating enough income that we could just slide right out of that and into the life that we're living now. And so I really want to encourage anybody that's listening to this. It doesn't matter if you're a doctor making six figures, or if you're making minimum wage, there are things that you can do that are going to set yourself up for financial success down the road if you're willing to do these steps. So the Hacker Method is, so how it came to be is when we decided to retire from the mission work, you know, we started to let people know, and inevitably people would say, what are you going to do next? Right. That was a hard question to answer because, you know, as a missionary, especially, we don't talk about money and politics. Those two things are off the table. And we're going to talk about faith. We're going to talk about restoring family. We're going to talk about other things, but not money and politics. And so people were basically asking me, well, what are you going to do next? And I said, well, we're going to take a year off. And they're like, well, yeah, but how are you going to pay the bills? And I was talking to this one guy, and I finally said, listen, we've been investing in real estate and we don't need to get another job. I'm just going to focus on the investments and this kind of stuff. And he just looked at me like blankly, like, what are you talking about? Yeah, well, totally.
His head exploded right there, right?
And he said, oh, how much did you make as a missionary? Like almost accusing me of something, right? And I was like, I don't know. I mean, like $3,000 or $4,000 a month was what we were making as missionaries. And he said, well, how did you do that? And I was like, well, I'm not exactly sure. He goes, do you think I could do that? And I was like, totally, you could do that. And he said, would you show me? And I was like, I mean, yeah, I'll show you, but I'm not even sure how I did it. And so that's what took me back. After I had several conversations like that, I sat down and I started to think through, okay, what did we do? How did we do this? And how can I communicate this in a way that the other people could grab onto it? And that's what became the hacker method. So what I discovered is there was five steps that we were running both sequentially and then looping back and rolling over and over and over again. And so those five steps are, the hacker method is the acronym. So hacker, right? So H is hack your lifestyle. When we were living on such a constrained income, we couldn't live like everybody else lived. So we had to figure out ways to make every budget category stretch. And so I list out five or six different hacks that we did in our lives, like house hacking, where, I mean, I was loath to pay any more than $300 or $400 a month for our housing. I wasn't willing to do it. Logic vehicle. So I have another acronym, L-O-G-I-C. So there's a formula that we used on what kinds of vehicles we would own or any at all. We lived in an urban area and we decided not to get a vehicle, even though it was more convenient, and just do public transportation, you know, so just all these different things that we did to keep our spending in check. And then the A step is allocation budgeting. So we came up with what we call the 50-40-10 budget. 50% of your income goes to your spending category. And because you've done all the house or all the lifestyle hacks, that can cover all that stuff. 40% of your income goes to investing, period. Don't spend any investing money on spending, and don't spend any spending money on investing, right? You have 40% of your money is to be invested, and then 10% to give it away to make the world a better place. So that's how you allocate your budget. And then CK is one step, cash is king investing. In that chapter, I talk about kind of my own evolution of how I began to understand the power of compounding returns or compounding interest, and why it's not okay just to save money. You've got to invest your money. And I use this analogy in the book that I really like of bodybuilding compared to investing. So if you want to get healthy, you go for a walk in the park. That's not bad for you, but it's not going to make you a bodybuilder. In investing, if you put money in a savings account, it's not bad for you, but it's not going to make you wealthy. Right. In order to get wealthy, you've got to get much better returns than the rate of inflation. And savings accounts, I'm sorry, almost all the time are just not as good as the rate of inflation. So you've got to get better returns than that. Just like you've got to bench a lot of weight and squat a lot of weight to become a bodybuilder, you've got to really push those returns higher. So you've got to become a better investor. That's cash is king. The next letter, exponentiality, is not a word, but it's a concept that I created. That once you've mastered the concept of getting, you know, 10 or 12 or 15% returns, now you need to get to that next level of where you're getting infinite returns, where or just like that really parabolic, that hockey stick effect of that can only come with time and pressure. I also like to say that diamonds are formed with time and pressure, and wealth is formed with time and pressure. The time is obviously just years, and the pressure is just how much emphasis you're putting in. You're doing your 40%, getting those good, healthy returns, and it gets to the point to where that hockey sticks up. And then R, there's actually four R's. The first one is you always need to review what you're doing. You can't just set it and forget it. You can't just hire the property manager and then go to the beach. You've got to review what's going on. Is what you've set out to do, is it still doing what you wanted it to do? If it is, then you got to have the discipline to repeat it, right? A lot of us entrepreneurs, we get shiny object syndrome, and we want to go chase the newest asset class, or we want to jump into the newest fund, or we want to, you know, stick to what you know, and if it's working, and repeat it. If it's not working, you need to rework it. And that's the time where it's time to pivot. So you need to learn the skill between, ooh, a shiny, fun object, and hey, it's time to pivot. And then the last R is reward. You know, for those of us who get really good at investing, we can almost get greedy and take all of our proceeds, or maybe even take some of our spending money and start throwing it into the investing category. And we just keep that machine going because we like to see that snowball, and we never stop and enjoy our own lives. And even from a biblical perspective, it's a chasing after the wind. Like, what are you doing? What are you doing? And why are you doing this? If you don't take some of that money out to bless yourself and to bless the people that are around you, to make your life better, to make the life of the people around you better, then you're starting to fall into kind of that category of being greedy. And so the last R there is to reward yourself for the efforts. And I tell people, if you take 50% of your income, take 50% of your exit events as well, and throw that into your spending category and begin to build that life that you've been working for.
I love this breakdown, and I had heard you speak about it a little bit, and I appreciate you just laying it out there like that. And even in the order that they're in is very intentional, right, as well.
Right.
But even just starting, like, you can't live like everyone else.
Right.
You know, just like think through that for a moment, because I know, you know, I'm as guilty as anybody, you know, until the last number of years. It's like anytime my income fluctuated, especially up, guess what? My living went up as well, yeah. Right? Yeah. I'm guilty, you know, until finally I feel like hit in the face a few times. And then it's like, wait a minute, you know, why did I do that? And then finally, I, you know, hopefully learn, right, from that. And that hopefully doesn't happen. But, you know, making, you said all budget categories stretch, right? Thinking through all those different categories. Maybe are there other categories, or is there a way that you lay out the categories that the listener could think through and just like maybe even today, some places that they're probably spending more than they think they're spending, you know, where they could do some hacking?
I did a workshop not too long ago, and it was a house hacking workshop. And I asked the audience to run the math and to find out what percentage of their take-home pay are they paying towards housing. And the number ranged from in the low 20% on the low end to, I had a guy who was paying 50% of his take-home pay was going towards his housing, just the housing. And I just thought, man, you must feel like you're drowning. You must feel suffocated because I just understand what it takes, you know, the cost of food and the cost of fuel and the operating a vehicle and insurance, my goodness, all these different expenses that we have to pay, and then to enjoy your life a little bit, you know, for entertainment. In my formula, I'm saying you need to take 40% of your take-home pay and invest it. And if your housing is 40% of your take-home pay, okay, there is the fish in the barrel that we need to attack. And house hacking is, in my opinion, the quickest, most painless, and I know that there might be some people that would disagree with that, but I can explain, way to get your investing money started, right? And take that massive monkey off of your back. So what happens in America is different from the rest of the world. And I've lived in six different countries, including the US. In most of the rest of the world, kids don't move out at 18. They don't have their own house when they're 23 years old or 25 years old. There may be 30, 35, or 40 before that happens, because they just culturally, they don't want to have that debt strapped onto their system until they're so stable that they can be able to easily afford it. Now, we in America, we make a lot more money. We have a different economy, we have a different system. And so it does make it easier for us to do it, but it doesn't change the fact that oftentimes if there's $1,000, we're spending $1,005. And that doesn't have to be. We make so much money in America. If we can be a little bit creative, like with a house hack, we can beat the system. And that's what we did, is we beat the system. Now, a house hack, like, I just quick one example. When we came back, actually we came back for COVID for about 6 months. When we came back, I decided to buy a house hack because I didn't want to have to pay a mortgage, right? So I bought this house that was a 2,500 square foot, 4-bed, 2-bath house, beautiful neighborhood, one of the best neighborhoods in Boise, Idaho. And it had a cottage on the back of the property. It was a corner lot. And so you couldn't even tell that the cottage was on the property. You didn't have to walk through the backyard or anything like that. I turned the cottage into 2 short-term rentals. And the revenue from that, if I was managing the property myself, which I wasn't, I was paying my company. But if I was managing the property myself, I would have gotten paid to live in that beautiful home. Gotten paid to live in that beautiful home. And so and that's not just me getting lucky. I mean, that's, you can find that kind of a thing. If you're willing to stretch your mind a little bit, do a little bit of extra legwork, do the work to get it set up, get the management systems in place, you can live for free. And then take the money you would have spent on that mortgage and start putting it towards your future. And you can build a multi-million dollar net worth. I don't care what you make as a salary.
Love that. And really that 50% needs to encompass not just housing, but really all your expenses in that model that you laid out, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Love that. And just the push towards that, even 40% towards investing. And obviously the sooner you can do that, the better, right?
Yep, absolutely. Mean, and,
you know, have you, you know, I guess, have you seen people do that at, say, 25 versus 45, you know, and the difference there?
Yeah, the difference is massive. If you can even stop investing, if you start early enough, you can stop investing while everybody else that starts when they're 45 or 50. And how many times have I had people come to me and say, I'm getting started late? And I'm like, well, I mean, it's better late than never, for sure. But why are we starting so late? You know, when you first start out, you don't have as many obligations. So get your budgeting system set up to where you can follow that for the rest of your life. But I don't have the math in front of me, but I've seen charts where if you start investing early and invest for 15 years or 20 years versus if you start late, you can stop investing while the other guy has to continue to invest because he started later and your net worth is higher than theirs because of the power of compounding over time, right? It's a mathematical fact. And it's proven out. We can't guarantee what's going to happen in the future, but we have a 100-year track record with the stock market, for example, of roughly 10% per year returns. If that's all you get, you just put it in an S&P 500 fund, you can pretty much bank on a 10% per year appreciation and you can do the math. So yeah, the earlier you can start, the better. And even though when you start earlier, your wages are, you know, typically smaller, it's still that power of time and compounding is so important.
Speak to how you would advise, say, that person early on, or maybe even, you know, some other ways you did this, that 40% chunk, like how would you advise to diversify that or where to put it or, you know, if they're early on, but even if somebody's getting started in their 45, you know, what would they do? You know, or how would you guide that? I know every situation is different, every person, their investing needs, their desires, all those things, but maybe just, you know, if they're brand new to this, they may not even know about the options that are available to be able to invest.
Yeah. So I would suggest somebody who's brand new, in my book, I have a chapter on the quintuple power of real estate investing. So the five different ways that real estate builds wealth and a lot of asset classes have one or two or three of those, but I've only seen real estate that has all five of the ones that I identify in the book. And so I really do always emphasize, hey, real estate, it's everybody's going to need a place to live forever. That's not going to change. You can't move into a Bitcoin, but you can move into a house, right? And so I really do always encourage investing in real estate. That said, I encourage people from the beginning, at least if you're intimidated by the stock market, at least put your money in a fund that is no fee, that is pegged to the returns of the S&P 500. And that takes 5 minutes of education. You can figure out what that means. It's not that complicated, which, by the way, is another message I want to tell people out there. Whatever job you do is probably harder than investing. There's just people in real estate or people in Wall Street, rather, have created all these fancy terms and all these things that intimidate all the rest of us normal people into thinking that investing is for the elite. That's baloney. It's simple. Running a nonprofit is way harder than investing. I'll just say that. So I just really want to kind of demystify the difficulty level of it. So get your funds into an S&P 500. Maybe take a portion of that out and start buying stock in individual companies so that you can learn how the market moves and reacts and you can understand. Because there's a lot of things that translate from investing in the stock market to investing in real estate because there's macroeconomic things at play that, I mean, they move in different ways for different reasons. But when you start to understand how markets function, it just builds your investing muscles and gives you an intuition to be able to act when there's opportunities. And so I just encourage people to start there. But then as soon as you can start getting into investment property, I do encourage people to do that.
What's your, say your long-term vision for you and your investing model?
Yeah, so we're currently at 36 units. My current goal, I've got 3 more years to get to this goal. I want to get to 90 units. And then from there, we'll reassess. But I feel like I've got a certain economies of scale with 90 units where we can start to get a little bit more efficient, a little bit better profit per square foot and better return on equity. And so that's what we're pushing for right now.
Are those going to be local to you? Will they be all over the U.S.?
Yeah, I would like to get into a couple more markets. I'm in two major markets now, the Boise, Idaho market, which is where I grew up, and then the Phoenix market, which is where I live now. But I would like to expand to a couple more markets just to continue to diversify. I diversify across different cities within a metro, and I want to diversify to other metros as well.
You know, I remember you saying you got that fourplex paid off. And then how do you look at debt on these rentals?
Yeah, so my personal philosophy has been to keep my debt to value ratio around 50%. And that's a super conservative play. And I mean, I lived through the 2008 crash. And so I was super thankful that I was actually debt free during that time. That really made it to where I had nothing to worry about. Now, if I had 50% of my properties leveraged, I still would have been okay. I would have been able to cover those payments with the rents that were coming in. But that's just a super conservative stance, and I'll leverage that to grow, but I quickly want to get back to that 50% loan to value.
What about just predictions that you have for, say, the real estate market over the next year to 18 months? And everybody's asking all the time, right? And our listeners are all often concerned about it, and nobody knows. Nobody has a crystal ball.
Nobody knows, yeah.
You know, what we believe is going to happen affects what we're doing, right? Whether we're buying or selling. So just what are your thoughts?
I operate under a thesis, and I always disclose to anybody who's talking to me that my thesis could be completely wrong. and you know, my short-term predictions usually turn out not to be right, but longer-term, they tend to be pretty good, pretty close. So, you know, we've been predicting rates would come back down now for a while, and they haven't. They've stayed pretty sticky. Well, that's not true. They were at 8, now they're at 7. So they have eased off of a pretty high rate. I would say I don't think we're going to ever see 3% mortgage rates again. If we do, we've got some major economic problem, and we're probably not concerned about interest rates, right? I think the Fed overstepped. I think they know that they overstepped. They brought rates down too low, and they held them too low too long. And I don't think they're going to repeat that mistake. It's just too inflationary. And it's not really, I mean, yes, it was great for those of us who held real estate, but at the same time, I remember when we were having double digit returns every year for several years, I was like, can we please just slow down? Because this is, you know, this is like a roller coaster going off of the edge here. We got it. This is nuts. And real estate investors, we all need predictability, right? So I think that the Fed, I think that they're going to do a better job. I hope. My thesis is it's time to buy right now. Because there's not a lot of competition out there for units. Rates are high. And even with rates being high, prices have not crashed. They've maybe corrected a little bit in some markets, but they haven't crashed. As soon as rates come back down, all of those millennials that want to buy a house are going to flood the market. Investors are going to come back in, and things are going to turn back on, and prices are going to head higher. And what's my basis for that? If you look at the U.S. Census, every year since 1940, every 10 years, we do a census. They have recorded what the median sale price of homes in the United States was. Every single decade from 1940 to 2020, we've never had a decade with less than 40% gain on real estate valuations in the United States. That's average, right? Some markets maybe did have a collapse. Some markets did much better. But our lowest decade return was 40%. Again, future is not predetermined, but the past gives us a pretty good idea what's going to happen. So I think if you're a buy and hold long-term investor, chances are very, very strong that prices are going to increase. And I think right now is a unique opportunity for us to buy to see some good appreciation, because we've basically been under a lid for 2 years. And when they take that lid off, which is the rich interest rates, I think we're going to see prices rise.
And Brian, just a few final quick questions for you here as we're running lower on time. What's your best advice right now for passive investors?
I think that the art of learning how to do due diligence needs to get stronger in people who are passive investing. I think passive investing is a fantastic way to build wealth, but we need to. I mean, it's you need to trust your operator. But you also need to take a look at their numbers. I think that that's just extremely important, whether that's your property manager or that's a syndicator or that's just a partner that you're going to do a one-off deal with. You really need to get into the numbers. That's my best advice.
What are some of the most important metrics that you track? It could be personally or professionally, just daily basis, anything that's important to you.
Yeah. So I'm tracking three things right now. I'm tracking body fat. I'm wanting to get my body fat into a healthier range. I went and did a DEXA scan and he said I had some visceral fat, and that just sounds awful. So getting a handle on that. In the real estate world, I'm tracking two numbers are kind of the most important to me. One, return on equity. And with my policy on having 50% debt to value, that compresses maybe my return on equity a little bit because I'm not leveraging myself to the hilt. But I do care about that number. I want to make sure that my equity is working for me. And then I'm also watching my profit per square foot. I used to look at profit per unit, but that wasn't fair to compare a four-bedroom apartment to a studio, a four-bedroom house to a studio apartment, right? And so now I'm looking at profit per square foot, and that flipped that ratio, right? My studios perform better than my four-bedroom houses on a per profit per foot basis. So I watch that, and I make sure if I have any laggards that we either address them or we swap them out for something else. Another metric that I'm paying attention to is staff retention, like how long do we have staff on staff, and what's our turnover rate? I think that if we can take good care of our people and keep them in, that's just vitally important to the health of the organization.
Habits that you're disciplined about that have helped you achieve success.
I have a pretty strict morning routine that includes, I call it my morning motivation. So it's just for myself where I go through, there's five different questions that I answer every day. And that's after my workout. And so I get a workout in every day, and then I do my morning motivations. And then I look at my calendar and I just make sure that my day is set the way it needs to be in order to be effective for that day. So that's my routine.
Love that. Number one thing that's contributed to your success.
I think in the R step, the four R's are review, repeat, rework, and reward. Being good at those, I think, is the most important. Probably the most important of those was just sticking with what you know. And that's hard for me to do because I'm the shiny object guy. I like to chase the new concept. So just sticking with it and just, you know, perfecting the thing that you really know well.
And then I love that, you know, you lay right out there, hey, 10% giving away, really, no matter where you're at in this investing game, right? You should be allocating so much for giving. And so how do you like to give back?
Yeah, I like to give back to causes that, I am a numbers guy. And so I like to see that my money is getting a return. Now that return doesn't have to be financial, but I want for my money to be well spent. And so I'm looking for organizations that are run well, that are doing a cause that is worthy of, you know, of receiving our funds, and people that are just like operators that are just sold out to the cause. That to me is the most important. I'm not as concerned about what they're doing. I mean, there's some things that I wouldn't fund, but I'm most interested in just making sure that my money is being well spent.
Love that. Well, Brian, I'm grateful to meet you and to walk through your hacker method. I think it's empowering, like I said earlier, for almost anyone, no matter what stage in their, say, career, you know, they're in, if they're brand new or maybe they've never invested and even they're a little bit older, you can start to think through this and start hacking these, you know, your lifestyle, right? Like you talked about in the 50%, 40%, 10% and working towards that. So you can be giving and investing and those things. So I love that. And I appreciate you just, man, laying that out. So like I said, so anybody can do it. And even walking through, you know, your path of being a missionary and really low income, but still making a way to make this happen. And now making a way to make it available to anybody. So Brian, right, how can the listeners get in touch with you, learn more about you and find your book?
So the book is on Amazon.com, BarnesandNoble.com, Walmart.com, Target.com, anywhere where you can buy a book online, the book is there. And I've actually started a community of people since I've had so many people say, hey, can you teach me how to do this? So we've started a community where you can come in and it's a coaching kind of environment, a mentorship environment where there's coaching calls, there's small group accountability, there's different tools that we're putting out. So that's at theunexpectedinvestor.com/community. So if you're interested in that, come check that out. And I'm on social media at Unexpected Investor on all the different channels if you just want to follow what we're doing there.
Awesome. That is a wrap. That's the end of the show, Brian. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Whitney. It's so good to be with you.